Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is quite simply no one who I think brings more intelligence to discussions of the war for the free world. Certainly no one who brings the depth of knowledge of the struggle for freedom over millennia, not just decades, than our first guest. He is Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, a noted classicist, a professor, an author, an historian of great renown, and not least a member of the Commentariat who excels in pieces like the one he wrote recently at National Review Online that I'm anxious to talk with him about, The Way of All Appeasement. Victor Davis Hanson, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have a chance to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
You draw five important parallels between what we are witnessing at the moment with what I call the Obama bomb deal and other acts of appeasement that really, I think, are so stunning, so clear, and so ominous that I wanted to make sure we had a chance to visit with you quickly about them. Would you mind enumerating those for us?
Yes. What I try to do is emphasize aspects of appeasement we usually don't think about. One of them, of course, is that the appeaser, that is the people who give the concessions, usually think they're going to be rewarded for their magnanimity, and they're usually despised as being weak. So in the case of the current Iran deal, we've already seen the Ayatollahs mock the administration and double down on their rhetoric, in the same way Hitler did to Chamberlain and earlier Stanley Baldwin. So there's something psychologically there that the Soviets probably like to deal with Reagan rather than the appeasing Carter, because and the same thing was with the Iranians, too. So people forget that, but weakness gives you no respect even from your enemies. Second thing is that it has a great effect on allies and the third party, whether it's Czechoslovakia in 1938 or Poland in 1939. They usually bear the brunt of the appeaser. The appeaser tries to shield himself in the way that Britain was an island and it wasn't connected to the continent, and France was way to the west, at least part of it, and this was an Eastern European problem in Czechoslovakia and Poland. And what we're doing is we're basically telling the Arab moderate, so-called moderate world in Jordan, Egypt, and the Gulf monarchies that you're going to deal with this bomb, you're in range, or we're telling Israel, you're in range, or we're telling even some of the Eastern and Southern European countries, you're in range, but we have a breathing spell because of our distance and our military clout. So it's going to be harder than them. It has also a larger effect on the tone of strategy in the world at large. So after really pressuring and lobbying the Chinese and the Russians to sign on to this deal, which was they fought from the very beginning, now we've sort of pulled the rug out from under them. It has effects on even our allies on other issues. Greece, for example, they were negotiating, and we being the Western powers, but specifically the European Union, was pretty tough on them. Now, what are they going to say? They're going to say, well, you gave more concessions to the Iranians on things that are existential in nature than you did on money with us.
Yeah, no, it's a really critical point. The one that I particularly wanted to address, though, Victor, is your notion that, not your notion, your factual analysis, that appeasers always wrongly insist that the only alternative to their foolish concessions is war.
Usually, I think there's no alternative. It's either or. In fact, there was no urgency for us to cut this deal with Iran. Everything was going our way. Their economy was sinking. Their oil was being stockpiled. It couldn't be sold. Their money was frozen. They couldn't get their hands on arms. Their terrorist appendages were short cash, and it was getting worse. So we could have just smiled, waved to them, and said, you know what, come back to us when you want to talk seriously. But, of course, we were under a deadline, and that was the deadline of the Obama presidency, that he wanted to cut a deal for a so-called legacy before he went out of office. And then, of course, the other thing is we always forget the effect on the domestic political opinion. There were people who really thought, General Halder in his diary said that Hitler might be gone by end of 38, because there was a real anger and apprehension that Germany wasn't ready for war, and yet here was Hitler trying to provoke it. And there were a million people on the streets of Iran in 2009, and there is a domestic opposition to the theocracy, but not now, because now the people on the street are going to say, well, what did you do to force? Look what they did. They got us prestige. They got us money. The economy's back. We're taking over the whole Middle East. We got the bomb. So it's destroyed the internal opposition.
And created a more dangerous Iran by far in the process. Despite all of this, Victor, there is some concern among those of us who are opposed to this deal that having engineered an arrangement in which this accord, which the president says is not a treaty, will be dealt with under legislative arrangements that make it exceedingly difficult to reject it, that this will go through, and that will not just be the Security Council, it won't just be the Europeans, it will be we who will also allow this to go forward. One of the things that I'd be interested in your thoughts on is whether there was, in the instance of, you mentioned Ronald Reagan earlier, his handling of the Panama Canal Treaty and what flowed from, ultimately, its approval by the Senate at the hands of some key Republicans, it should be said, that might be a model for a kind of jujitsu or lemonade making out of this lemon for Republicans who are opposed to the bomb and Iran and the foreign policy of this administration to boot.
Yeah, and Reagan was the lone voice in the wilderness, and he used that issue to introduce a whole critique of the Carter administration. He said what he did in the Panama situation, giving this strategic asset away into an unstable country, which, by the way, was pretty prescient when you look what the Chinese are doing in Panama. That is a metaphor for the arms talks with the Soviets, for Soviet behavior, for the whole perception of U.S. weakness from Afghanistan to the Tehran to the Chinese. At the time, he said that, and he was right. So it's the same thing. It has repercussions that the ripples of this treaty go well beyond just Iran and the United States. And I don't, as far as the so-called treaty versus a resolution, I don't see how they can stop it, because our assumption was that it was a treaty, so then you need a two-thirds majority of the Senate. And now, because it's a resolution, you really do need an override of the Senate. So he's flipped a third of the Senate necessary, and he's going to override this veto. So it's not a question of whether it will be approved, but only when, and unless there's some development. The Iranians you never can count on. They can always say something or do something very radical, but I assume that they'll tell people to shush and tell Hezbollah to calm it down a little bit, Hamas, and then as soon as it's ratified and approved, then we'll see what the ramifications are.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Victor Davis Hanson is our guest, hailing from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he is the Martin Illy Anderson Senior Fellow in Residence. Let me just ask you one last question. The New York Times features prominently today a story that there have been requests for criminal investigation by the Justice Department by two inspectors general, including the Inspector General of the State Department, of Hillary Clinton, for her handling of classified information and, more generally, I guess, her email insecurity. Can you give us a quick assessment, Victor, of how that might have come about and what it might portend?
We know the Obama Justice Department is entirely politicized, so any hint of a prosecution is political in nature, and that goes back, A, to the 2008 acrimony between the two, Obama and Clinton, and more importantly, they do not want her voicing criticism of the last 8 years on the 216, and she's too centrist, they think. She's pretty left-wing, but they'd rather have a left-wing candidate, even if the left-wing candidate lost, than have anybody critique, because we all know what Hillary's going to do. She's going to run hard left in the primaries, and then she's going to forget all of that criticism and move to the center and sort of ankle-bite the Obama administration when necessary for her own political viability, and they don't like that. So they're sending her a message, you know, better be careful, because and they did this with Menendez, Senator Menendez, on the Iran deal, and they do it with everybody. They're just shooting a cannonball across her bow and saying, you know what, we're going to be monitoring you, and you better be very careful because you may get an indictment.
Yeah, it's the Chicago way. I think even just the fact that they've identified this as potentially criminal activity and there was classified information on her machines is going to be a problem.
There obviously was, but in the Obama administration, it's just a question of what's the political dividends or not to follow the law.
You will be monitoring it closely. We look forward to reading your writings on it at National Review and elsewhere. Victor Davis Hanson, and hopefully talking with you about it in the near future as well. Thanks so much for joining us. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council tells us what he told Congress this week in opposition to this fatally flawed Obama bomb deal. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war, from Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ilan Berman, a man who has really contributed mightily to our understanding of so many of the international challenges that we're facing. In his capacity as the vice president of a highly regarded organization in Washington, the American Foreign Policy Council. Among his many books is Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America, one of the many facets of the Iran problem with which he is conversant. In fact, so much so that he was called to testify earlier this week before the House Financial Services Committee about the deal. I call it the Obama bomb deal that President Obama has struck with Iran and a number of other nations. Ilan Berman, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be back.
You have been busy, and helpfully so, for sure. Talk, first of all, if you would, briefly about the deal as you see it overall and what you said to the Financial Services Committee this week.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's necessary to understand the deal in context. The deal does have some positive aspects in the sense that a little bit of oversight of Iran's nuclear program is better than none at all. But if you start walking through the 150-some-odd pages of the deal, what you actually see is an arrangement that's very deficient in a number of key respects, and it is, frankly, a tremendous benefit, not to us and not to our understanding of Iran's nuclear program, although we will have more, but to Iran and to Iran's political and economic futures, because the centerpiece of the deal isn't a rollback of Iran's nuclear program. It's a preservation of it and a massive flood of sanctions-liberated money that is going to really serve as a shot in the arm for the Iranian economy.
I did want to just note, Ilan, that even the upside that you see to it is obviously very restricted in terms of what we'll actually be allowed to see or to monitor and the extent to which that is of any bearing on the actual capabilities of this Iranian nuclear program, to say nothing of all the rest of the things that are seriously deficient, as you say, about this agreement. We're visiting with Ilan Berman, the vice president of the American Foreign Policy Council, about his assessment of the Obama bomb deal and his testimony about it before the House Financial Services Committee this week. Ilan, just to press a little further on this, among the things that I think you have described as being very deficient here is the various aspects of Iran's hegemonic ambitions that will be not only made much more readily achievable for them, thanks to the money, the windfall by some estimates, $150 billion, maybe a bit less, but an enormous amount. And I want you to talk about that with us in context, but also the kind of opportunities they will have to get access to conventional arms and ballistic missiles and heavens knows what else. Give us a flavor of all that, if you would.
I think that's exactly right. And actually, the money really, for me, sits at the center of all of the problems that are inherent in the deal. Because just to put this in context, the administration has talked publicly about liberating between $140 and $160 billion in funds, oil revenues that Iran has sold and received, oil that Iran has received revenue from, and that's been held in escrow in places like China and South Korea and other places. The part of the deal, part and parcel of the deal, is that we begin to repatriate that money to Iran and do so very quickly within the first 6 months or so that the deal is in effect. But those numbers are large, obviously, but they're not so helpful if they're not in context. So it's useful to point out that in 2014, the annual gross domestic product of Iran was $415 billion. So what you're essentially talking about is increasing Iran's annual budget by a quarter or more. It's actually a complete reversal of what we've seen over the last 3 years. Over the last 3 years, if you ask the Treasury Department, they'll tell you that Western sanctions levied by the U.S. and Europe and others have constricted Iran's economy by about a fifth. What you're looking at now is not only wiping that slate clean, but actually helping Iranian growth. This is a Marshall Plan for the Islamic Republic.
It is indeed, and this is a very important and apt analogy, it seems to me, because to the extent that that is what they're about, they're building a new world, in a way, in their part of the planet, if not more broadly, including, as you've observed in your book, Ilan Berman, the hemisphere south of our border, not least. This is a windfall that will be very, very ominous, I think, for us and our interests, as well as, of course, of Israel and so on. One of the impetuses behind all of this, quite clearly, was the ambition of some of these negotiating partners to get into Iran to make money. Talk, if you would, about what happens when the Germans send their trade delegation in, as they've done this week, or there's a Iran-EU, a European Union business forum taking place in Vienna at the moment, in terms of compounding the windfall and giving these guys even more resources with which to make, well, war against us.
No, that's exactly right. And so what everyone who is skeptical of the deal has feared would happen is already beginning to happen, which is that unlike what the administration says, in which the president has said publicly many times that if Iran doesn't comply with the terms of the nuclear deal, sanctions will just snap back. But the reality is that this idea of snapback is a fiction. It's a fiction because as soon as the nuclear deal is concluded, you see massive volumes of international trade re-entering the Islamic Republic in a way that's going to boost Iranian funds still further, in a way that's going to make it almost impossible to return to the place where we were before, where even though sanctions didn't hermetically seal off the Islamic Republic, they were stringent enough to cause some pain. What you're seeing now is exactly the opposite. Even if the United States rejects this deal after deliberation in Congress, even if we return to the sanctions regime, what we're going to find is that the international community has other ideas, and international business has re-entered Iran in a way that's going to make it much harder for us to isolate them.
Indeed, you may find them, in addition to international governmental and other figures, being in place to advance the Iranian nuclear program, something provided for by this deal, or to protect the Iranian nuclear program, something endorsed by this deal. The capacity of these guys to turn all of these folks into human shields in the event that something does go bad for them is another consideration, as you know. Hey, speaking of the whole question of things turning, let me ask you, Ilan Berman, as an expert, among other things, on Turkey, to explain what has just happened as a result, we're told, of months of haggling with the Turks about the use of Incirlik air base by American and NATO forces against the Islamic State, and I gather Turkish forces as well.
No, that's right. And so what you've actually seen, the big sea change in the fight against the Islamic State terrorist group is what's happened over the last 36 hours in Turkey, where you had a significant terrorist bombing in Turkey that has made it untenable for the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan to actually have this hands-off approach that they've had for such a long time. And it's useful to understand why the Turks have been so uncooperative for so long, because from the start of the civil war in Syria, the Turkish government's official declaratory policy has been that not only must Bashar al-Assad in Syria go, but we're going to help him go, which has made them essentially complicit in the conflict and the chaos that's going on in Syria, and also in facilitating the flow of foreign fighters
to the Islamic State, among other bad actors, indeed. Ilan, this is a subject we're going to drill down more on in the future, if you'll indulge us. We're hard out of time at the moment, but thank you very much for the work you do at the American Foreign Policy Council. Congratulations on your recent testimony, and we look forward to working closely with you in opposing the Obama bomb deal. Next up, we will speak with Tennessee State Representative Judd Matheny about his state being the capital of American jihad. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. For years, Charles Jacobs of Americans for Peace and Tolerance has warned about the Islamic Society of Boston. That mosque was founded by a top Muslim Brotherhood operative and Al-Qaeda financier, Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi. Despite ties to him and a dozen other prominent jihadists, this Muslim Brotherhood front has been given preferential treatment by local and state officials and whitewashed by most press organizations. The Islamic Society of Boston has even been called a model partner for countering violent extremism by President Obama. Fox News has just revealed, however, that a moderate former clerical leader in the Boston area's Muslim community, Imam Talal Eid, now confirms Islamic supremacists at three local mosques, including the ISB, have, quote, exerted a radical influence, unquote, on the mosque's leadership. We must shut down, not extol, such incubators of jihad. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at peaceandtolerance.org.
This is Frank Affney, host of Secure Freedom Radio. I wanted to encourage you to attend, if possible, and certainly to monitor a very important development on July 22nd. It will be the Stop Iran Now rally in Times Square, a rally for peace through strength, with a number of the most important individuals in our country working to defeat the Obama bomb deal. For more information about this important event, go to info@stopiranrally.org. Thanks.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word: answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, for the first time by a man I have been admiring greatly from afar. He is a state representative in Tennessee by the name of Judd Matheny. He has been representing the people of Tullahoma, Tennessee, the 47th district in his state, for some years now, capping off years of service in a variety of other capacities, notably as an 8-year veteran of the United States Army and Tennessee Army National Guard, also as an 8-year veteran of state and local law enforcement. Perhaps his most significant public service, however, is that he's rendering right now in the state legislature of Tennessee, notably in connection with leadership on a host of statutes that have really try to address what is now being described by no less a source than Politico as Tennessee being the capital of American jihad. Representative Matheny, thank you so much for joining us and for all you've been doing for our country and for your state. It's great to have you with us.
It's my honor, Frank, and thank you for your service to our nation also, and thank you for the resources you make available to help us fight.
We're privileged to be able to give you a hand and especially to give you a very round, warm of applause. Let me start with this proposition that Politico is describing your state as the capital of American jihad. We've had, of course, the recent episode in Chattanooga, but that's not the only problem that you've been confronting in Tennessee, and I'd like you to sort of give us a 30,000-foot level view of what's been happening there and why.
Absolutely, sir. Since 2009, we've had a pretty serious issue with mosques beginning to radicalize young men in Tennessee, and I can even go back to 2007 with some pretty much confidential briefings now that I can make some details public that I was given by the FBI that Al-Shabaab was operating within the borders of Tennessee. In 2009, Carlos Bledsoe, a young, up-and-coming Memphis native, was radicalized in a mosque in Nashville, and a short time later bombed a Jewish rabbi's house in Nashville and then murdered a U.S. Army recruiter in Little Rock, Arkansas. Little did we know, 6 years later, we would see the exact same thing in Chattanooga, only with five dead. However, some of us in the Tennessee General Assembly heard the call and saw the alarm, knew from our military service, knew from our law enforcement backgrounds, knew from our relationships with security professionals that this was a real issue, not a lone wolf attack, that there was a very dedicated and intricate network of financing and material support, almost like an underground railroad, if you will, to support these organizations that ran through the mosques, through various business dealings, through immigration and migration services. So we began to think of ways we could put roadblocks into stopping future jihadist attacks. And one of those was to go after the networks, the financial aspects of those networks. So we passed the material support for designated entities law in Tennessee, which is still probably today the strongest law on the books on the state level. It allows any local prosecutor to go after a designated terrorist entity as designated by the U.S. State Department list, like Hamas, for instance, would be one, or Hezbollah, or ISIS, or Al-Qaeda. And a local prosecutor can actually, if they get information that someone is knowingly supporting a group like that, they can go after them. That is a reactive tool. Once something happens, we backtrack. So we've paid the price again in Chattanooga with a almost exactly similar case. We have a young man who, by all accounts, was a fantastic student, graduate of a Tennessee school, went overseas, came back, bam, committed a much more atrocious act. Very well planned. Acts like this don't occur out of the blue. What did he do for us? He proved that Carlos Bledsoe was not a lone wolf attack. He proved that this is a repetitive series of attacks. Frank, it's not unlike ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Jordan or Syria or some other country firing an artillery round directly from the country and hitting us in downtown Chattanooga, what happened last week.
Let me ask you, Representative Judd Matheny is our guest from the state of Tennessee, and you are, as I've indicated and you've now just described, championing some model legislation, really, not just important in your own state with all of the problems you've described, but one that could be employed elsewhere to good effect as well, and I hope will be, using the Tennessee example as a building block. But let me drill down on something that you alluded to early on, that these individuals are being radicalized in Tennessee mosques. They're further, I guess, intensifying their commitment to jihad and their skill set in executing attacks pursuant to it through travel overseas, apparently. But this is not a lone wolf thing. This is something that's being incubated, it sounds like, Representative, in the mosques in your state. Is there anything that can be done? As a guy with a law enforcement background particularly, is there anything that should be done in terms of surveillance of these mosques to try to prevent this kind of thing from happening proactively?
Yes. And all it takes, in my opinion, is a shift of the resources that are available now. I'm a former law enforcement officer, and I know what I'm capable of as far as surveillance and reconnaissance. And it's been 25 years, Frank, since I've been on the street or been a criminal investigator for the state of Tennessee. And I knew what equipment and what capabilities I had then, and they were decent. I was quite effective. Today, it's incredible the technology that's out there that one officer can use, license plate readers and cameras and GPS satellite imagery. But we spend so much time misappropriating those resources to problems other than radical Islam because we refuse to see radical Islam as the problem. I've received three different security briefings in the state of Tennessee from security officials, and every time white supremacists operating in Tennessee have had a much higher focus on our security agencies than have Islamic jihadists. However, we have had no mass murders committed or no murders that I'm aware of that have been committed in the name of politics by any white supremacist. However, we've had five times, 10 times that many committed by Islamic jihadists. So there's a political correctness here and a misallocation of resources. We have to begin to somewhat I won't say profile, but almost profile 18-year-old, 26-year-old Middle Eastern males that rise to a certain level of suspicion within certain levels of Islamic communities, because these people are being picked as candidates for terror operatives, sent over for final training as soldiers and sent over here to fight and die.
But Representative Matheny, it seems to me, if I may, just one other piece of this is you have to recognize that the guys who are bringing them to a state of readiness to die or certainly at least kill in the name of jihad and furtherance of the Sharia agenda are the imams in these mosques. It's the pedagogy of these madrasas. It's the books and other videos and so on that are in their bookstores and the like. And that seems to me to be something that has to be addressed as well. In part, let me turn finally to another thing you sort of alluded to, but ask you to address how this may be contributing to the problem in your state of Tennessee, namely refugee resettlement programs. You have, in the state of Tennessee, essentially turned the whole project over to a contractor of resettling these people. Talk a little bit about what contribution you think these refugee resettlement programs are making to the problems that you've been describing so well.
In 2008, our governor, our then governor, executively turned over Tennessee's authority to the refugee resettlement program to private contractors who bid with the State Department, and mostly that is Catholic Charities, to handle the refugee resettlement program. Since then, the program has been steadily abused, used as what I consider to be a profit center, and by many to be a profit center. We've seen an expansion of refugee resettlement activities and a compression of normal charitable activities coming out of Catholic Charities. What we see are thousands of Muslim, mostly refugees, coming in almost on an annual basis from countries that we have known terrorists operate out of. There are known intelligence reports, and there are known rings of infiltrators coming in through refugee channels of ISIS individuals, most of them migrating through Europe and into London, and eventually sometime make their way here.
It's clearly a problem. I hate to interrupt you, sir. We are hard out of time. Let me just say the fact that you're focused on the problem and you're trying to address it, as you have several other of the contributing causes to the jihadism in your state, is deeply appreciated, as is your long service to our country in other capacities. Keep it up. Representative Judd Matheny of Tennessee, God bless you, sir, and it's been a privilege to talk to you. We'll talk again, I hope, soon. Seb Gorka joins us next on the celebration of the first birthday of the Islamic Caliphate. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Dr. Sebastian Gorka, one of the most thoughtful analysts and influential teachers on matters involving the global jihad movement. His recent books include Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. He has also got several books forthcoming, and I might just tease them a little bit because they're going to be important insights into the challenges we're facing for sure. One is entitled Killing Jihad, the other A Citizen's Guide to War, American Military Actions in the 21st Century. He is the Major General Matthew C. Horner Distinguished Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University. Dr. Gorka, welcome back, sir. It's good to have you with us.
Wonderful to be back on the show. Thank you, Frank.
Well, you have recently written what I think was one of the most trenchant pieces on a problem that we still insistently seem unwilling to acknowledge, and that is this caliphate business that the Islamic State has established, as you note, a year ago, just about now. It's celebrating its first birthday, and it's come a long way, baby, in the intervening period. First, I guess, Seb, talk a little bit about this group. The president insists on calling it ISIL. What do you call it, and what is it really about?
Well, you always have to call a threat group by what it calls itself. We call the Third Reich, the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union. That's how you do your intelligence preparation on the battlefield. And we are facing the Islamic State, or the Caliphate, if you wish. This is the name that it calls itself after Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of the organization, last summer in the Grand Mosque of Mosul, no less, declared the reestablishment of the Caliphate after 90 years of absence, and himself as the Caliph, as the new emperor of the theocratic Islamic Empire. So, you know, let's call it what it is. Let's not distort the raw intelligence that seems to be the fashion we have of late to allow politics into the intelligence cycle. I like to call it ISIS, or more accurately, the Islamic State, so IS style.
And why is it, Seb, that the president doesn't? Why does he refer to it with this meaningless acronym, or at least meaningless for most people's purposes?
Well, I think because of what I just mentioned, that we've had a systematic, politically driven distortion of the intelligence cycle and the national security functions of the United States in the last 6 years. So we're not allowed to use the words the enemy uses about themselves. When they call themselves jihadists, we should remove reference to religion, to jihad. As we know, the deputy spokesperson of the State Department has said that there's no ideology involved. All we need are jobs for the terrorists. So we have an ideologically driven perversion of the national security function, in which certain things are forbidden, cannot be discussed, and specifically those things that allow us to understand the enemy and so defeat him. So unfortunately, it's politics that's being driven into the understanding or the analysis of the threats that America faces today.
And Seb Gorka, you have witnessed this firsthand from your teachings and training efforts inside the government. You have been, as a serious student of history, conversant for sure as to what the implications are of this kind of practice, this willful blindness, as I guess what Andy McCarthy calls it, political correctness, if you will. I'm pretty sure that what the jihadists call it is submission. What would you say to our listeners, or if he were one of them, unlikely as that may be, the president of the United States, are the risks associated with persisting in this kind of behavior?
Well, I think, you know, the way to illustrate this best is with a very simple analogy. If you went to a doctor and he used his tools to diagnose you, and he saw that you are actually suffering from a metastasizing cancer, but instead, for political reasons, he said, well, you know, you're suffering from flu. Go home and drink a lot of liquids. That's what we have right now. That individual would be committing medical malpractice, and we have the same political drive today. Don't get me wrong, Frank. The operators, the special agents, the special forces, the members of the intelligence community at the lower level that we work with, they get it, they understand it. But when their management or when the SESs, when the Schedule C political appointees are telling them, you know, remove references to the ideology of jihadism, take out the things that the bad guys say about themselves, well, that will only lead to misdiagnosis. And there is no way to defeat an enemy if you are not allowed to speak truthfully about who the enemy is and what motivates him. That's the enormity of the issue, Frank.
Indeed. Because this is a contagious disease. It's not just that the patient is dying. This is something that is going to afflict more and more of us if we persist in this. Just talk a little bit about the four characteristics of the Islamic State that you describe in this piece. And by the way, folks, you can find it at thegorkabriefing.com, a very important essay on the birthday for a caliphate. What is it that prompts you to say this outfit is in a unique class among the world of global jihad movements, and why it's imperative that we both understand it properly and deal with it properly as well?
The first thing of the four, and it's all open source, unclassified, is that IS is a fully-fledged insurgency, unlike Al-Qaeda. In the last 14 years, Al-Qaeda attached itself like a parasite to indigenous pre-existing insurgencies, whether it was the Taliban in Afghanistan or Al-Shabaab in Somalia. ISIS is different. It generated its own insurgency and now holds territory greater than the territorial expanse of the United Kingdom. So this by itself puts it in a new category. And also, it's not just an international insurgency, it is a transnational one. With Boko Haram pledging fealty to Abu Bakr, we have a threat group that's operating in at least three countries, not just in the Middle East, but also West Africa. Second, it's the richest threat group of its kind in human history. We can ignore the illicit oil sale through Turkey, the extortion, the selling of antiquities. If we just look at the two raids on the Iraqi National Bank, ISIS walked away with $823 million in cash. That's the equivalent to 1,609 letters. So that by itself makes it preeminent. Thirdly, it's recruiting figures, stunning recruiting figures. In 9 months, it recruited more than 19,000 foreign fighters. So that's in excess of the Syrians and the Iraqis. That's Brits, Americans, Australians. That is a stunning capacity to recruit that Al-Qaeda never came close to. And then we have, of course, last, as we've mentioned already, the thing that really makes it special is that unlike the Muslim Brotherhood, unlike Al-Qaeda, it has finally managed after 90 years to create the caliphate. This is something that the other threat groups had wanted to do but had failed. ISIS actually made it a reality.
Give us in 1 minute, if you can, Seb, your prescription for what you do about a threat vector with these characteristics.
Well, firstly, we have to make sure that the fight on the ground is happening. This can only be accomplished by redeploying our advisors, our trainers. So we have to have all the troops that were removed by the president have to be put back in place. The people who really could defeat IS, like the Egyptians, have to be convinced of our support of their campaign. But the larger part is everything that you've talked about, Frank, for so long, and that's the counter-ideological campaign. That's when we take the fight to the enemy on the strategic level where they recruit. We have to just as we countered the legitimacy of communism and undermined it and said, look, this is a totalitarian ideology that everybody must reject. The same must be done for global jihadism. But we haven't even begun to scratch the surface in the last 14 years. It would be nice to do so finally.
Yeah, well, you've got to accept that there is such an ideology, as you say so well, Seb Gorka, that is at our throats and therefore must be defeated if you're going to have any chance of actually accomplishing it. Dr. Sebastian Gorka, it is a delight to talk with you, as always, from the Marine Corps University and the Gorka Brief. Check it out at thegorkabriefing.com. Thank you, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your vacation and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will join us again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.